Mission, and this is probably one of the more difficult parts of the book, simply because Peter is teaching us things that if we are not always tasting and seeing that the Lord is good, these kinds of things taste bitter. And I think it is often bitter to have to read something and know that it's true. And could you back that off a little, Ramya? And not really want to obey it. There's a lot of things that I know that are true, and I don't want to obey them. And that's something that's difficult to do, because then what one has to do is say, well, what is it about this thing that I don't want to obey? If I know it is true, and I know that it will make my life better, and I know that it will sanctify me, and it will build me up in righteousness and truth. These are and not because it will feel better, but because I have been promised that by God. Right? Not that in the submission, everything, you know, oh, okay, everything will kind of go away and you will be shown to be a saintly person. No, maybe things will stay about the same. But what is promised by God is that by following His truth, right, we're built up in righteousness and holiness. And those are things that bring us peace of a different order. So, today we are talking chapter 3, verses 1 through 12, and this is one of the funner parts. I had a lot of fun reading this last night. I don't know about you guys, if you had fun reading it. And I don't want to pretend that I have wisdom beyond my years. Tabby and I were married 6 years in June. And so, yeah. Not very long. So we're still, kind of practicing what these kinds of passages teach us. But I do want to be faithful to Peter's teaching, and I don't want to say, oh, well, this is one of those hard parts of the Bible, and what we need to do is just kind of work this out individually. What does it mean to us in our own marriages? Peter didn't write this letter to a wife. He wrote it to all wives, with the knowledge that all wives are very different and all marriages are very different. Right? So he wasn't thinking to himself, oh, there's this one person and she has real trouble with submission, so I'm going to just really encourage her in that way. Right? Now, it is particular. He does identify that these particular things are written to wives. He's not saying husbands and wives submit to each other. He is saying that in different ways, but in these particular verses, he is saying that. But in the end, he gives us something that's very interesting as far as to contextualize that and give us a better understanding of what does that mean in regards to the other work that he's been doing in the book as far as thinking about what is it that the church needs, what is it that households in the church need, and how can the church be built up by strengthened and peaceful households? Right? That's what Peter's trying to encourage here. He's not trying to encourage domination. He's not trying to encourage suffering. He's trying to encourage peaceful households. Because he knows that if the households of a church body are at peace, that church body will be highly productive. I've never been an elder, but my father was an elder and still is an elder. And I don't have to know much to know that a church suffers when there are households that are not at peace. And it maybe isn't the suffering that we see on Sunday morning in a congregation, But it's something that diminishes the congregation in a very kind of secret way that is probably more dangerous than, say, something that everybody can see and know about and pray for that person and support them and encourage them, right? And I know that's true. I know it's probably true of our congregation, and I know it's true of a lot of other congregations who are striving earnestly to follow God and to follow His truth. But peaceful households are something that are fundamental to a peaceful and productive congregation. And Peter knows that. And so he's looking at, what is it that promotes peace in a marriage? What is it that promotes peace in a household? How can a marriage be a blessing to people in a marriage? And how can a marriage be a blessing to a church body? Okay. So I have a general question first, unless anyone else has a question or comment. A last caveat, which is, hey, if I'm out of line, you know, if the wives think after this, you know, this guy is cuckoo, he doesn't know what he's talking about, just write me a letter or tell me after the class. I don't care. I'll take the criticism. Okay. If you need to set me straight afterwards, a lot of you have been married for many, many years and have a handle on this, so I would enjoy the advice and the rebuke, I guess you could call it. I am. I'm encouraged, though. Okay. First question is for everyone. What kind of submission do we find the least burdensome? Maybe some submission you think is a real joy. I don't know. But I think in general, at times, even when sometimes submitting is great, if you're always submitting to a particular kind of person, sometimes all submission is burdensome, equally, same plane. The Spirit opened your eyes. Mm-hmm. Right, so someone that loves us. How do I write that? Yes, sir. Not Mexican food.
And so one who was just was pleasant and knew
Has anyone had a boss that they know loves them but still really hard on you? Still easy. I will do whatever you want. I know that you want me to do these things because you want me to be better, whatever it is. But I have bosses in graduate school, just terrible. I mean, just say terrible things to you, and none of that stuff ever felt bad. I could tell that they wanted me, they loved me, and wanted me to be better. They wanted me to be a true scholar. And that requires a tremendous amount of discipline. And they were the one to enact that discipline. But I knew that they loved me, right? And so it was not burdensome, even though the workload was astronomical. The burden was very light. Here's the thing for me, though, and I like that you said Christ sets an example for us, because did Christ submit to anyone else besides his Father? What about Pilate? What about the Sanhedrin? I don't think the Pharisees or the Sanhedrin loved Jesus. Doesn't appear to be the case, right? In fact, they love to strike him in the face, beat him, criticize, terrorize. Yes, Lydia. I'm not looking for the opposite. I'm just thinking it is easy to submit to someone who loves us. And so we say, yes, I will submit to people that love me. That's easy. And I was thinking to myself, was it the submission to the Father that Christ struggled with? Or was it the submission to these people? Not only does he bear the burden of their outward affliction, but he bears the burden of seeing the darkness of their hearts. And to see the darkness of their hearts and still being silent. Which one of those people could Christ have called out immediately? Any one of those people he could have pointed his finger at and said, I see the devil in your heart. I mean, we already talked about where the authority lies, right? The authority is in Christ. And in his submissive stance. Because in his submissive stance, what he grants is mercy. I give you mercy in my submission. That was hard, I think. That's why he was sweating bullets. I mean, or blood, whatever. That's a hard thing to do. To be gentle and quiet in the face of that kind of hatred. Yes. Lydia. I'm sure it was hard to be forsaken by God. I can't imagine that. In my life, as a Christian from a young age, I can't imagine what it would feel like to be forsaken by God. And I'm sure that that had something to do with his anguish, anticipating that event. But I think there's a lot to be learned from what Christ and how he juxtaposed himself against everyone who supposedly had authority. But didn't just supposedly have authority. It's not like Christ said, well, all of you guys, I mean, you just have illegitimate authority. I'm the real honcho around here. I mean, there was some he did say some very pointed things, right? I would not be here, right, unless my Father, right? He does acknowledge that the authority is administered by the Father. But he doesn't say, but since I'm the Father's Son, that just, you know. He says, Pilate, you know, you're a terrible leader. I submit to you. Okay? You know, instead of actually taking control of the situation, you're just trying to placate the people, right? The Sanhedrin, you know, corrupt. Well, you could say whatever you... I mean, you can't say things worse than what Christ said about them, right? Who they were. He says, I submit to you. I submit to your authority. That's quite a burden, I think. Having to submit to people that not only do we think, well, not it wasn't just like, I'm not sure if these people love me or a lot. I'm kind of unsure about that. Where do I stand in relationship? I think Christ was pretty clear about how he stood in relationship to the Pharisees and the Sanhedrin. And even Pilate, who's totally ambivalent. I mean, that's the weird part. That's almost worse. Almost worse than being like, you know, Pilate's just like, well, okay, fine. I'll crucify that guy. He's innocent. I know, but well, whatever. You know, I'm bored. Let's do something else now. Okay. That's kind of a hard thing, I think, to think about when we think about when we're asked to submit to someone. When Peter says, submit, and he says, and by the way, Christ is your example. I'm like, man, that doesn't seem like, that's not egalitarian, that's not kind of negotiating. That seems like absolute and utter oppression. Right? I mean, we've had a lot of good teaching about what it means to be in a marriage. And I think that the Christian, the legacy of the Christian church has done a lot to promote and encourage good marriage. But I also don't think that I think that in some cases, what we think to ourselves is that, well, now what we have is better marriages than what they had before. Right? I mean, before women were held down and the men just kind of were masculine and did what they wanted. That can't be true. I think people living in the early church had really good marriages. Why not? They strove in holiness and righteousness. Oh no, but they lived in these ancient cultures where... What? That can't be true. The early church was filled with people, right, who had good marriages. Some of them were obviously not so good, right? Because Peter's saying, okay, you guys are getting a little off kilter here. Let's think about how to get this, right? Yes, Dave. And we have a great standard, right? Perfection. Well, not perfect. Well, you're supposed to be, right? I read it in the Bible. Okay? Yep. That's exactly right. Makes it doubly hard because we get a glimpse of what Christ saw in his own submission. we get a glimpse of the fact that all of us are, right, hateful, spiteful, unkind, selfish. Not because people tell us that, but because the law gives us a glimpse of what people should be like. And then we say, that person doesn't stack up against the law very well at all. Maybe I should not submit to them, you know? Make my life kind of miserable. I'm just going to submit to Christ instead, not those people, right? So, second question. This has to do with what I'm thinking about in regards to what the act of submission actually does. So this is for wives. Wives to answer, husbands to think about. In what ways do you witness to your husbands? While you think about that, I want to read something St. Augustine wrote about his mother. He lived in North Africa, so it was probably a very, very masculine culture. I don't know. I don't really know. But he never writes anything about his father except that he was a ne'er-do-well and didn't do very well most of his life. But he loved his mother deeply. So, I'm going to trust his opinion. He says about his mother, "She was brought up modestly and soberly in this manner and made subject by you to her parents rather than by her parents to you." Right? So she didn't even grow up in a Christian home. "When she arrived at a marriageable age, she was given to a husband, and served him as her Lord." And I think that he's quoting there, actually, Peter. "She strove to win him to you, speaking to him about you through her conduct, by which you made her beautiful, an object of reverent love and a source of admiration to her husband. She endured offenses against her marriage bed in such wise that she never had a quarrel with her husband over this matter. She looked forward to seeing your mercy upon him, so that he would believe in you and be made chaste. But in addition to this, just as he was remarkable for kindness, so also he was given to violent anger. However, she had learned to avoid resisting her husband when he was angry, not only by deeds, but even by words." And there's some other stuff in there. But at the end, he says, "Finally, towards the end of his earthly life, she gained her husband for you. After he became one of the faithful, she did not have to complain of what she had endured from him when he was not yet a believer. She was also a servant of your servants. Whosoever among them knew her greatly praised you and honored you and loved you in her because they recognized your presence in her heart, for the fruit of her holy life bore witness to this. She had been the wife of one husband. She repaid the duty she owed to her parents. She had governed her house piously. She had testimony for her good works. She had brought up children, being as often in labor in birth of them, as she saw them straying from you. Lastly, Lord, of all of us, your servants, for out of your gift you permit us to speak, who, before she fell asleep, in you already lived together, having received the graces of your baptism. She took care as though she had been mother to us all, and she served us all, as though she had been a daughter to all of us." Augustine says some very interesting things about his mother, and he does describe a situation that I think most of us would never wish on someone. I certainly don't wish it for my daughter. I don't wish that she would have to submit to a husband who practices an infidelity or is not a Christian, or all of those things. But in his discussion of his mother, you see how he's talking about, he's really talking about Christ. He's saying, my mother was doing the work of Christ as a wife. I never really thought about it that way, what my mom did. But I was thinking, another way to think about what a wife does, right? You're Christ's accomplice. I think some of us think about witnessing and evangelism, and we think about those things and we think, oh, man, if I could just win people to Christ, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be great if I could just go out and tell people about Christ and they would just be one to Him? I don't think anybody in this room would say, no, I don't really feel like doing that. I would prefer not to be a role in someone's life and have them one to Christ. But I don't think there's any distinction about how many people it is, right? Does it have to be more than one for it to make a difference? If we bring one person to Christ in our life, I feel like that's what Augustine is saying about his mother. I mean, he's saying it's like you gave her this project. You gave her to this man so that she would win him for you. That's the work that Christ does, right? He was given to us for the same purpose. That makes me think that submission saves people. And I don't think it's just submission to your husband, right? I think that submitting in general, as Christians, to unjust, unrighteous authorities is an act of witness. It saves people. Right? He talks about his mother, and it's not just, oh, she was submissive to a non-believing husband for many years who did not treat her well. But out of that singular suffering work that she did, so many other people were able to see Christ in her life. She did more work by submitting to her husband in service of the kingdom than she might have done in other ways. That almost sounds too easy, right? Oh, I just, that's all I have to do? I don't know. Kind of makes me want to be a wife, you know? I don't know. You know, see, try it on for a while, see what it's like. I wouldn't want to be my wife for sure, but somebody else's maybe. Yeah, right. You guys get all the teaching, and then I'm like left out there. What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? Okay, right. Okay. Submission saves people. I think if you didn't learn anything from Peter except that, it might be worse. That might be worse something. But I want to move it one step further because I want to think back into some of the stuff that Peter has been teaching us about sacrifice of the Spirit. And he's saying the same thing here to wives. And so this is a no answer necessary question. Okay? I don't want somebody to answer this question, but I want to ask it. Okay? So, wives, how do you make a sacrifice of your spirit? Part of that has to do with what Peter asks wives to do. Be gentle and quiet. I wish Gail was here today because she'd be in my case for that, right? Gentle and quiet? What are we like in the 1920s or something, right? Women, you know, seen, or this is children seen and not heard, but, you know, whatever. I mean, there's women too. There's all these kind of anachronistic understanding of the way things were back then when women were just kept quiet and in the back room and cooking in kitchens. And that stuff is true. Not, you know, not making light of that to say that's not the way it was. It was that way. But the ruse or the foolish way to think about that is to say all of the women that were that way were made that way. None of those women were willingly gentle and quiet. They were forced to be that way. I might get rebuked for some of that stuff, but I think it's the same way we think about marriages in the early church. Women in the early church, women in past ages, whatever. And we think, none of those people really did what they wanted to do. It was kind of like the circumstance of their time. And I don't think that's what Peter
for